questions on anything?
Do you want to write all that down?
Well, so my recommendation at the start of class is that, particularly if you don't take notes, it's smart to record these review boards, because that's kind of the only hard copy review you're going to get. There shouldn't be anything here that wasn't on the board before, though, so in some sense it shouldn't be new. So last time we were talking about the application of the idea that we can learn about how the solar system works by playing with toys here on Earth, that the same rules that apply to falling apples apply to falling moons. And I started out by saying that two words that you don't want to use if you're going to get some credit in this class, and that is inertia and centrifugal. They are pseudo forces. They are not actually real forces. Common misconceptions about how the world works. So instead of a outward pointing pseudo force, we have a real force that is required to push things around in a circle. So we talked about Newton's version of billiards, where if you have a constant hitting of the bumpers, constantly pushing the ball towards the center, as we get more and more walls on our pool table, we're getting closer and closer to real circular motion. And in the case of circular motion, we have to have some force that's pulling towards the center. And in this case, it's the string. I can feel that the string is pulling, and I can feel if I make it go faster, I have to pull harder on it. In the case of the solar system, what's doing the pulling of the planets, pulling them always towards the sun, but never in fact hitting the sun, is the force of gravity. And if we just use the formula that's actually not too difficult to derive for what the acceleration is for something that's going in a circle, and we equate it according to Newton's second law to the force divided by the mass, we pretty quickly come to the result that the orbital speed is slower if you're at greater distances, and that there's a particular formula that applies. If we look at the time it takes to go around the period, we just plug in this formula for velocity, we reproduce Kepler's third law, which says that the period depends on the radius to the 3/2 power. Now we've done a little bit better than Kepler because we actually know what the constant is that relates those two. We just said that they were proportional, but now we know that if the sun's mass were different, we know how the periods of the planets would change. And that turns out to be really important because it's a way of calculating the mass of Jupiter. Remember that, generally speaking, the mass cancels out. So there's nothing in the orbit of Jupiter that tells us how much Jupiter weighs. An apple having the same speed as Jupiter would follow the same path. So if we want to measure the mass of Jupiter, we need to find something that's going around it. And in fact, has moons. So if we measure the radius, the distance that those moons are from the center of Jupiter, and the period, we can calculate what the mass of the thing in the center is. In this case, Jupiter, as opposed to the sun. So that plays kind of a big role with, for example, Pluto. People misguessed the mass of Pluto early on, and they thought it was a much more massive planet than it turned out to be, because no one noticed a moon around Pluto. Turns out Pluto does have a couple of moons that they've been discovered in the last 10 years. So we now have good evidence for the mass of Pluto, and it's pretty small. And that's what played a big role in it being demoted, getting 8 planets as opposed to 9 planets that there were when I went to grade school. Questions about centripetal stuff? So then we talked about conservation laws, 3 important conservation laws that are not new material. They're consequences of Newton's law. You can derive them directly from Newton's law. Newton didn't do that. He never figured out, he probably in some sense knew about these laws, but certainly never pronounced them and never raised them as particular issues. So certainly the most important law in all of science is the law of conservation of energy. And the idea is that energy comes in different forms. But if we look at the numerical value in those various forms and add it up, it always remains a constant. So the energy that goes into the coal that fires the power plant, if we look at the heat that's given off and the electrical energy that's made, The total energy that's in the coal is eventually converted into thermal energy and electrical energy. And we talked about throwing objects. When I throw an object up, you can see that initially it has some kinetic energy. Its kinetic energy is converted into potential energy when it goes up. And then we have an unconversion of potential energy back to kinetic energy when it falls back down. We have a particular formula, which we're not going to make much use of, for the gravitational potential energy. So gravitational potential energy is zero if things are way separated, so there's no force on them. And as we get closer and closer and closer together, we're going more and more downhill, so we're going to negative numbers for the energy, gravitational energy. And that turns out to be the appropriate formula. And if we look at the energy that's necessary to escape, we have to have, in the end, zero energy. So if we just take the kinetic energy plus the potential energy and set them equal to zero, we find out what the velocity it takes to escape. And again, turns out that the masses cancel, so we don't have an escape energy, we have an escape velocity. Any object that's moving the square root of 2 times the orbital speed, in the case of escape from the surface of the Earth, about 25,000 miles an hour, is gone. Momentum conservation is going to play probably the least important role for us. It's a direct consequence of Newton's third law. And kind of the usual example of it is shooting a gun on ice or something like that. The bullet has a lot of momentum in one way. You have an equal amount of momentum, but a much smaller velocity since you have more mass. Momentum being the product of mass and velocity.
What exactly is m sub s again?
So I'm thinking about it as being the mass of the sun. But for all of that, it could just be the mass of the thing in the center. So if we were trying to figure out what the mass of Pluto is, we could plug in the orbital period and the distance that Charon is from Pluto, and we could calculate the mass of Pluto. So it's the mass of the thing that the thing are orbiting about. More questions? So angular momentum is going to be much more interesting to us, and it works a whole lot like momentum. We have the thing that's like velocity, which is RPMs, how fast something is spinning. And instead of having the mass, we have what's called the moment of inertia, which roughly, crudely speaking, is something like the mass times the distance that mass is from the spin axis. And we saw the ice skater effect, which is going to be, for us, probably one of the more important phenomena, that if you bring your mass closer to the spin axis, the result is you have more RPMs, because the product of these two has to remain constant. So if I get small, RPMs has to increase in order to compensate. And it turns out that conservation of angular momentum is exactly what's behind Kepler's second law, this funny aerial velocity law. When the planet is close, when the planet is close to the sun, it's like having a small moment of inertia, and it's going to have a faster RPMs past the sun. And when it's further from the sun, it's going to move slower. Talked about gyroscopes. If there are no external twists, then the angular momentum of the gyroscope has to be constant, so it'll point forever in the same direction, no matter how the body of the gyroscope is held. So if we have a gyroscope that's spinning this way, and it's moving, for example, around the sun, it'll always point in the same direction. And that's pretty much what's the case of the Earth. Earth's spin axis is pointing during our lifetimes to Polaris. But it wasn't always the case. Very, very slowly, the spin axis of the Earth is pointing in different directions, tens of thousands of years in order to switch. Right? But Aristotle goes back 2,500 years, so it was quite noticeable over that period of time. So what's the cause of this is the small twist that the moon is putting on the Earth. The Earth is a little bit unsymmetrical. The moon is trying to get its spin axis oriented in the plane of the moon's orbit. And that is causing this precession of the Earth's spin axis. Questions about any of that? Well, let's take a second to take a look at one of these cheesy demonstrations again. I can find this to plug it in. Yeah. Let's. It is plugged in. Okay, good. Please clean filter. Yeah, I really should phone that in, but I haven't done it. Okay, so what we have here is a kind of an example of how the solar system works, and you can see that the planet Mercury that's close to the sun is going more miles per hour, and since it has a smaller track, it's taking less time for it to actually complete an orbit. And we made a plot of the period versus the radius of the planets last couple of times ago. And if we change the mass of the sun, then everything just has to go correspondingly faster. And you might remember that when I presented these graphs, so you guys plotted the data that's on this black line. And it turns out that if the sun were more massive and it were, Pluto, for example, is about 10 AU from the sun, the result would just be that for a less massive sun, it would take it longer to go around. And for a more massive sun, it would have an orbital speed that is faster. And that all looks a little bit nicer on this funny graph paper. Right? We still maintain a straight line. If the sun is less massive, then it takes longer to go around. The sun is more massive, then it would take less time to go around. And there's finally a detail that's maybe worth mentioning. So there are no unmoved movers. So the sun is pulling on the Earth, but the Earth is also pulling on the sun. So the center of mass, the teeter-totter point between two objects, is actually the thing that's at rest. The sun is also in motion. It's also going in a little circle, always falling towards the Earth but never hitting it, for the same reason that the Earth is always falling towards the sun and never hitting it. And we can obviously change that teeter-totter point if we increase the mass of that star, decrease the mass of that one, then the teeter-totter point becomes closer and closer to the heavier star. And in fact, in the case of the sun, the teeter-totter point is actually inside the sun, given that the sun is way more massive than the Earth is. If we have an equal mass case, I don't know if I can do that here, can I? So I want to make this one 2. I can't quite get it exactly to be 2. But here you can see the teeter-totter point is pretty much halfway between the two stars and kind of looks like they're sharing an orbit, but they're both always falling towards each other and missing with the teeter-totter point in between. Questions? Well, I think it's should be pretty obvious that the topic today has to do with sound, but actually more generally it has to do with waves. And we are going to be interested in sound waves, for example, coming from the sun eventually, but the primary reason we're talking about waves is because light is a wave. And if you look at the chapter that we're about to start, you see that it's starting out with light kind of immediately. But I like to talk about these other sorts of waves first as a kind of a more familiar introduction to the idea of light being a wave. So, I mean, certainly the most common sort of wave is a water wave. Right? So if this is a pond and you throw a rock in the center of the pond, you know that you get these ripples that go out more or less circularly symmetric around wherever you threw the rock in. And if you were to look at a cross section of the lake, Right? So here's the lake bottom someplace, and here's the original flat version of the surface of the water. These ripples are places where the water is stacked a little bit higher, stacked a little bit lower. And this pattern of ripples is moving in some particular direction. And we like to kind of invent some nomenclature to, since we like to have vocabulary tests, have some vocabulary to describe these sort of waves that are general and not particular to water waves. So the kind of the primary thing we should be thinking about a wave is the distance between two peaks. That's called the wavelength. Okay, it's the length, not the height. Distance from crest to crest. It would also be the same distance from trough to trough. And it's universally denoted by the Greek letter lambda. Now, wavelength is closely related to a kind of similar idea, frequency. Right, so the word frequency suggests something is happening repetitively, and this is a measure of how repetitively it's happening. So the idea for frequency is we're sitting in a boat here, and we're counting the number of waves per second that are going past us. So, in kind of old-fashioned nomenclature, this was called cycles per second. And these days, we like to name things for famous dead physicists, so these things are usually called hertz. So we got wavelength, frequency, and we also have the wave speed. And if you just kind of think your way through it, if we have several waves that are going by per second, we can figure out how fast they have to go because all of these wavelengths had to go past us one after another. So the wave speed has to be equal to the frequency times the wavelength. And I'll use the letter F to denote frequency. Okay, so kind of automatically, if we're talking about short wavelength waves, that's going to mean that they are automatically at a high frequency since they have to multiply together to give us the same wave speed. So the other parameter that's useful to have a name for is how high the waves are. Now, technically speaking, for water waves, if they tell you that they're 10-foot waves on Lake Superior, what they're talking about is the distance from peak to trough. But that's not what we want. We want the distance from equilibrium to peak or from equilibrium to trough. That's called the amplitude. So the wave height is the amplitude, the wavelength is the wavelength. Number of waves that go by per second is the frequency, and how fast the waves are going is V. Now, we can make all of these statements because we can see water waves. In a more generic sense, kind of the first question you should be asking is, what's waving? And in this case, it's pretty obvious. What's changing is the distance that the top of the water is from any spot, say the lake bottom. So sometimes we have a high pile of water, sometimes we have a low pile of water. It's the depth from the peak of the wave down to the bottom that is constantly changing. Okay. And it's maybe worth commenting that the kind of automatically, as these waves get spread out over greater and greater circumference in this case, the amplitude is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. There's going to be some sort of law that relates how far the wave has traveled from the point source And as a result, the amplitude is less and less and less and less. Okay, questions, water waves? Okay, so that allows us to introduce this vocabulary. How about sound waves? So I'll leave these keywords up here, right? Wavelength and frequency, because they will apply to everything. So I said the first question that you always should ask about a wave is, what's waving? So presumably, if I were to draw a line from my mouth to your ear, something like that would apply. So what is it that's going up and down for a sound wave? Well, what does air going up and down mean? Ah, so you think the air might be going like this. Nope.
Doesn't it like condense and expand?
Yeah. So what's going on here is that when we're talking about a high, what's happened is the air has moved longitudinally. It's been compressed. So I use that word compressed. Rarefaction is the name for the opposite phenomena. Obviously, if we have initially uniform lines and we expand these, then automatically we've contracted those. So here we have a compression, and here we have a rarefaction. So I think that's a description of what's happening, but I don't think you've told me what quantity is it? What is it that I could measure that's up and down? Louder? So decibel is the way we measure amplitude. And it's a funny way of doing it. So what is it that is, what quantity is changed in a rarefaction and a compression that we could plot going up and down?
Pressure.
I like that. But you know what I'm going to ask is, what's pressure?
Molecules per unit of space.
I like that too. That's not pressure though. I'm going to call that density. But certainly density is pretty obviously changing, because if I've expanded the air, I have the same amount of air in more volume. And you remember that density was the mass per volume, so obviously the density is low in that refraction, and it's going to be more compressed in the, it's going to be higher in the compression. What's pressure? That's a perfect definition of it. It's the force per area. So my wife complains when her cat sits on her stomach, and she claims that there's a huge pressure from those tiny paws, but of course that's only a 15-pound cat. Right? But it feels like a lot of pressure because it's a noticeable force in a pretty small area. So one place that you all should have run into pressure before is in filling your car tires. So what's the number that you're supposed to put your car tires to?
It's like 35 or so PSI.
PSI, right? I think 30 is a pretty common number. Yeah, for a bike it would be like 100 PSI. And for off-road vehicle it might be a lot less than that, because you want a floppier tire. What's the PSI stand for? Yeah, so it's a force per area, right? So it's pounds of force per square inch. So, do you know that there is pressure currently every place in this room? So let's take a take probably more than time than we should to talk some about pressure. Now let's start by talking about water pressure, because I think it's probably the most usual sorts of things. So you all know that if you're, you know, a mile underwater, you start to worry about being crushed by the pressure of that water. So evidently pressure is something that increases when we go down deeper into the fluid. What we'd like to figure out is, what is that relationship? What fundamentally, what is pressure? And if we know fundamentally what pressure is, we should be able to figure out what the pressure is if we're 10 meters down or 100 meters down or a kilometer down. Let me start by asking kind of a crazy question. So think about a cubic meter of this water. Why doesn't it fall?
Because it's supported by more cubic meters of water.
Say again?
Because it's stacked.
Well, I kind of like the idea of it stacked. So what does the stacking do?
It piles it up and focuses the pressure.
So if we have a stack of books, it's going to work pretty much the same way. So why doesn't this book move? It weighs something, so there's a force on it down. There better be a force on it up too, or else it would fall, right? So at this surface, it's being pushed up. And the fact that it's being pushed up isn't particularly obvious, but I think the fact that it's pushing down on its neighbors is perfectly obvious. And you know that Newton says, if this book puts a force on this one that's down, this book puts a force on this one that's up. And of course, the same thing applies here. This guy is being pushed down by these books, and it's pushing up on those books. But it must be, since it's not accelerating, it must be that the net force on that book is zero. So for this cubic meter of water, it weighs something, so it's being pushed down. But the bottom water is pushing it up, and the top water is pushing it down, and the sum of all of these things has to be zero. Well, instead of making that a cubic meter, let me take it all the way to the surface of the water. So this is some big stick of water. So we know that this thing weighs something, so it's being pushed down with a force that is just the mass of that object times g. So it must be being pushed up at the bottom with an equal and opposite force. Sometimes it's called the buoyant force. I'm just going to call it a pressure force. And we can calculate that pressure force by taking the actual pressure times the area. So the pressure down here in the ocean has to be such that the pressure times the area of the bottom of this prism has to match the mass of the water that it's supporting. Pressure is literally the weight of what's on top of you. Well, remember that density is mass per volume. And kind of unfortunately, we have a funny word, a funny letter that we use for density, the letter rho, Greek letter rho. And the volume of this thing I can calculate because it's the area times the height. So the mass is going to be the density times the area times the height. Ooh, those things look a lot alike. My P's and rows look a lot alike. And the areas cancel out, so I hope you can see that the pressure is just the density of the fluid times the acceleration of gravity times how far down you are. So we sit under an ocean of air, so there's pressure. Literally the weight of the air on top of us. And roughly speaking, it goes up or down, but roughly speaking, I think I'll just say 15 pounds per square inch. And when we say we're going to run our tires to 30 pounds per square inch, we're actually saying that in addition to the 15. So they're 45 pounds per square inch inside of our car tires. And what that means is that every square inch of the tire is being pushed out 45 pounds. It's also being pushed in by 15 pounds from the outside, but that's what pressure is. So sound is a lot like water depth, right? So the water depth was oscillating about some big number because the lake was 10 meters deep and the waves were only an inch high. So here we have oscillations in the air pressure above or below this usual value of about 15 pounds per square inch. So what's waving? We got two answers so far. That the pressure, because when you compress a gas, the pressure goes up. The density, because if you've expanded the gas, there's the same amount of air in a larger volume, so the density had to go down. And there's another thing that's also waving all at the same time. So if you filled up your bicycle tires, you compress the air, anything else change about the air?
There's more of it.
Well, there's more of it in the tire because you put it in there. Anything different about the air when you compress it? It pushes out because of the pressure. There's something else that's different about it. It's not different for long because it reaches equilibrium fast. Maybe you're all floor pump users, so you don't get close up close and personal to the air. If you actually have to hold the end of your pump, you'll notice that the temperature changes. If you compress air, it gets hot. So all of those things are changing, and if I plotted any one of them between my mouth and your ear, they'd be going up. So we'd have more pressure, more density, more temperature in one of these compressions, and we'd have less pressure, less density, less temperature in one of these rarefactions. Okay. One of the things that makes sound waves a little bit tricky is for a water wave we can see that there's more water and less water, but we can't see the extra compression or the lack of compression of air, right? Air that is compressed is just as transparent as air that isn't compressed, and so we don't see any difference between the rarefactions and the compression regions. So if we actually want to see sound waves, We have to have something that measures pressure, density, or temperature, and incidentally, most commonly, pressure is what you use, and somehow converts it to another form that we can actually display. That's what a microphone does. So a microphone senses the pressure and converts that to electrical stuff, technically speaking, a voltage. Electrical stuff is just fine. So as the pressure increases or decreases, the voltage that's being produced by that microphone will increase or decrease, and we can therefore measure the pressure that's going by when we have a sound wave. Yeah, I meant to have this on all this time, but so what we have here that probably people in the first row can see and no one else is a microphone. Still warming up. Go, go, go. That's why it would have been smart to have this on at the start. And I think I have to push the any button. So this is a device that converts the sound pressure to things that at least people in the front row can potentially see. And we can, in fact, measure and see what's going on with these sorts of things. So let's actually start with this thing here. So this is a synthesizer of sort. It makes electrical stuff that then goes through this little amplifier and goes to the speaker. And if I have things hooked up right, we can simultaneously display. I have to get this thing. Paying attention to this wire. And right now you don't hear anything because I have turned off the amplifier. And I can read off what's going on here. So what this says is that the frequency is 346 hertz. And we can see what the size of that wave is on the screen. So if I go to higher frequencies, there's a little glitch that happens at 1 kilohertz, 1,000 cycles. So you can see that at this region, the wavelength has gotten a lot shorter. So what's the difference between that and that?
The number of waves when passing?
Yeah, but your kid sister isn't going to say that. Yeah, I like the word pitch just fine. So apparently, in sound, we experience different wavelengths and frequencies as differences in pitch. And the lower the frequency, so 440 hertz is orchestra A. I don't know if any of you have perfect pitch or not, but that's supposedly 440 hertz. If we go to higher frequencies, the wavelength gets shorter and the pitch goes higher, right? We go A, B, and C down the keys of the piano. Well, I think it'll be obvious what amplitude corresponds to, but let's check that out too. Right, so you can see that wave got bigger, now it's getting smaller. I guess it won't get smaller than that. So what does amplitude correspond to? Yeah, I think what people would usually call volume. Loudness, decibels is typically how it would be measured. Okay, so let's run frequency again. So we're starting at orchestra A. 500 hertz, 600, 700, 800. There'll be a glitch at 1,000 hertz. So now we're at 1,200 hertz, 2,000 hertz, 3,000 hertz, 4,000 hertz, 5,000 hertz, 6,000 hertz. And the waves have gotten so close together, I guess you can't see them anymore. I can spread them out again, and at the same time, oops, wrong knob. Have the wave fit in terms of its height. So we're at 6,000 hertz and rising. You can see that things are getting closer and closer together. So we're at 8,000 hertz. Everyone can still hear 8,000 hertz? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're at, there'll be a glitch at 10,000 hertz. Did you hear the glitch? 10,000 hertz, 12,000, 13,000, 14,000, 15,000. Yes, no? Maybe. I can't hear it. Old ears aren't as good as young ears. So we're now at 20,000 hertz.
I can't either. Who can?
So traditionally, people say that the hearing goes to 20,000, young hearing goes to 20,000 hertz. It's obviously different between different people, but there's for human, so the sound is still being made, right? This device is still producing the sound. So this is just a matter of your ability to pick it up. So apparently there's a high limit that in round numbers is 20,000 hertz. Okay, we can go the other way. We're at 20,000. So we're at 16,000 people now hearing that. It might may pay to be closer. 15,000. I can now definitely hear that at 12. 10, there was a glitch at 10,000 hertz, we're at 9, 8, 7. I'm going to do something that is bothering me a little bit. Oops, wrong button. Yeah, I'm going to be happier with it set like that. Okay, going down. Longer wavelengths, lower pitch, 4,000 hertz. There'll be a glitch at 1,000 hertz again. We're at 3,000, 2,000. The bomb falls. There is at 1,000. I can change scales to bring it back. We're still getting longer wavelengths, lower pitches. 300 hertz, 200 hertz. 120 hertz, I'll expand out the scale. There'll be a glitch at 100 hertz again, I think. There it was. 80 hertz, 70 hertz, 60 hertz, 50 hertz. I think I can still hear 50. Some people can, some people can't. So this thing is still making sound. I don't know if you can hear it or not. But the traditional kind of round numbers for the range of human hearing goes down to 20 hertz. So we, of course, call the low frequencies the bass, the high frequencies the treble, and we've got that range. So this is all human perception, this 20 to 20,000 hertz. I mean, you know that dogs, the dog whistle set to a relatively large bell, can hear frequencies well above 20,000 hertz. So those frequencies that are above our hearing but still exist are called ultrasonics. And, yep. So there's a great commonality between how all animals are constructed, and the closer you are related to them, the closer the similarity will be. So we all the mammals have pretty much the same structure inside the ear. So what exactly does an ear have to do? It has to somehow or other convert this pressure difference into something that can biologically go to the brain. So what pressure means is things are going to be pushed on to varying degrees, and we have an eardrum in our ear that's like a drum head. As the pressure increases or decreases, it's going to get bigger or smaller. And that's transmitted through a series of three bones into an inner ear, which has kind of a spiral shape. And it pushes on the fluid that's in the inner ear. So it's kind of maybe seems unusually complicated, right? So here we have pressure, and through a bunch of stuff, it's converted again into pressure inside your inner ear. But then we have very delicate nerve fibers that are in this inner ear that can detect those changes in pressure. So there isn't anything fundamentally different between dogs' ears and our ears, except basically these things are all designed to be more responsive to high frequencies. So there's nothing fundamentally difficult of measuring things that are, well, things that are changing rapidly. If it's going to respond to it, they have to be made smaller typically. And it's kind of no surprise that it works the other way too. So big creatures like elephants and whales, we know, respond to these lower frequencies better than we do. And very commonly, bird chirps and insect noises go way beyond what even dogs hear. Questions? Okay, well, we got some stuff here. Let's see what it does. So I can turn off, what's going to be the best way to turn off? So I'll turn off this amplifier, and I'll make this guy not pay attention to that lead and instead pay attention to the lead that's connected to the microphone. I'm going to want my glasses so I can see what I'm doing. Okay. Let me change the scales just a little bit. So I can hold the wave. So here we have a particular wave that's made by this guy. Kind of a lowest pitch, I think we would agree with. And here's the cousin of this one, just physically smaller. I don't know, you can see that this one is roughly a centimeter or so in size. And now we have much shorter waves, right? So short wavelengths, high frequencies, physically a small object. Right, and if we go to baby version yet, higher in pitch. So you can see, of course, that these things, the physical size of these objects, gives us a hint about the wavelength that they're going to produce. Right? The bigger guy is going to produce a big wavelength, which is to say a low pitch, and the smaller one is going to produce a small wavelength, which means a high pitch. So here we have the usual. So let's see what they look like. Oops, not quite fast enough. I'm not happy with that. I'm moderately happy with that. So what's the difference? So you know that you can tell what sort of instrument is playing by what it sounds like, right? So this thing maybe is playing exactly the same note, I doubt it, as this is. Yeah, something. There are different pitches, but even if they were the same pitch, you could immediately tell the difference. So why is it that two instruments could be playing exactly the same frequency but sound different? It must be more than just frequency. So I don't know, let's take a look at these guys again. Yeah, I want a little bit bigger scale. What's the difference?
The shape of the wave.
Yeah, the shape of the wave. When I was running this synthesizer, the shapes were always perfectly sinusoidal. They look just exactly like that. Well, even more perfect than that. And you can see this one doesn't look like that. It's got this little bump on the side. So different wave shapes, even if they have exactly the same frequency, are going to sound different to our ear. There's another way of saying it, seemingly different stuff, but is equally correct. So one answer is wave shape is what's different between the organ pipe and the xylophone. Anyone else have any possible right answers? Any music majors? No one wants to admit it. So it turns out famous dead physicist Fourier was the guy who had this in mind. We can analyze waves both in terms of their shape, what they actually look like, but we can also analyze it in terms of the harmonic content. So somebody who's playing an A on a trombone is simultaneously playing that A and the next A and the next A all together at the same time. And if you have lots of waves together at the same time, it's going to change the apparent shape of the wave. So the set of harmonics that are in a particular instrument determine that fundamental characteristic that isn't described by frequency, difference between those two guys. So here's, yeah, I think that was it. So the following is maybe a demonstration that has no relevance to this class, but if you were a music major, which I guess there aren't any, so maybe it doesn't matter, would be of noticeable import. So what I have here is two of these guys. There's that one. And there's that one. They sound pretty much the same. So let me try and play them both at the same time. I don't know if I heard it. I hear it now. Try it again. So what do you hear? Yeah, it sounds like they're always getting softer because they use up their energy. But it sounds like it's getting louder and softer, louder and softer, louder and softer. And these things are stamped 440, which is orchestra A, and 441. They just differ in frequency by 1 hertz. So your ear can't really tell the difference between those. But if you think about what's going to happen if we have simultaneously present two waves that are slightly different, so they can start, where's an example? So here, for example, both of them are producing highs at the same time. So when they're both present, we have a super high. On the other hand, around here, This one is producing a low at the same time this one is producing a high, so together they don't make much. So we have this phenomena of lots of sound, little sound, lots of sound. It's called beats. And this is how orchestras tune themselves, right? So you have one person playing orchestra A, you play your own instrument at A. If you hear this beating phenomena, loud, soft, loud, soft, loud, source, you can adjust your instrument until that disappears, and then you're in tune with whoever started playing orchestra A. Okay. So, we're not going to worry a whole lot about beats in this course, but we are going to worry a whole lot about the Doppler effect. So I've got another one of these kind of cheesy demonstrations which is supposed to explain the Doppler effect. I bet it's going to tell me to clean the filter again. We'll see. Oh, it's magically cleaned itself. So I guess I don't have to report it. Ah, it heard me. Now it says the function isn't available. Okay, so what we have here is a helicopter, which is going to be the source of a sound. And what's special about it is I can have the helicopter moving at various speeds, and we can kind of see what's going to happen. So first of all, right now the helicopter isn't moving, and if it puts out sound, kind of no surprise, that's what it's going to look like. But let's see what happens if the helicopter is moving towards the guy. So what you can see is that the waves have a shorter wavelength because the source of the sound has moved towards the guy than they have over here. And if I make the difference, so I'm about doubling the difference that it was before, the more I increase the velocity of the helicopter, the more the difference between what the wave usually is and what it is when it's approaching the observer. So waves get shrunk here and they get expanded there. Right? And of course it works the same in reverse. The helicopter is moving away from the guy, the corresponding waves get expanded. So if you've ever hitchhiked, at least that's where I mostly hear this effect, it's pretty common. The car goes rolling by you as it tires are making some particular noise, and as it approaches you, it's a high-pitched noise, and as it goes by, it becomes a low-pitched noise. Okay, so it's some risk. That's nice. It stopped just when I threw it. I can hear it just with that, actually. Can you hear a difference in pitch as it goes by? Right. So that works for me. This one doesn't work for me because I'm in the middle, but I'm told that it works. So do you hear a wobbling pitch as it approaches you? I don't hear anything different. So the upshot of this is that moving sources or moving observers change the apparent pitch and wavelength of the wave. And Doppler's this famous dead physicist who actually put an orchestra on a train, that's the time frame for this, and had them play an orchestra A, and people with perfect pitch as the orchestra went by said it doesn't sound like an A. So the change in wavelength depends on the velocity that the source or listener is moving divided by the wave speed. So if you're moving a very small fraction of a wave speed, and of course I'm not moving at a good fraction of the speed of sound when I'm switching that, the change in wavelength isn't very big. And of course it's the same story with the change in frequency. Now, for us in astronomy, what's going to be important is this allows a way of measuring speed. So we can measure how the frequencies of light, in this case, have changed, and we can calculate then how fast the object is going. So this is basically how the police get your speed. They bounce radar waves off of your car, and the change in frequency of those radio waves tells them how fast the car is, in fact, going.
And that's why it's hard for them to pick you up during the ride.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind having that confirmed. It actually depends on the wavelength they use. So it's the same thing as with Wi-Fi, right? So sometimes Wi-Fi won't go through rain, but it depends on the wavelength of the...
Last storming day, same thing with like dish and stuff, you know, digital or dish TV.
Yep. All of those frequencies are affected by the stuff that's falling through the air. So I should add the name Doppler to this. Okay, questions about sound?
Doesn't the Doppler effect also affect like the color that we see of the object?
Yeah. So that's kind of a yes and a no. So mostly yes. Now we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but what we said was that how we experience different frequencies of sound is as pitch. How we experience different frequencies of light is by color. So that if something is moving a good fraction of the speed of light, then the color that it'll, say it's emitting yellow light, if it's moving towards us at high speed, then we'll see that as blue light. If it's moving away from us at high speed, then we'll see it at red light. The reason I said yes and no is in order to have a big effect, you have to have a big fraction of the speed of light. And in the solar system, there aren't a lot of things that are moving a good fraction of the speed of light. But in terms of a small effect, not one that you can see with your eye, but one you could measure with instruments, we do that all the time. More questions?
Mach 1, is when you reach the speed of sound, right?
Yeah, so Mach number is the ratio of the airplane speed to the speed of sound.
So my question with that is, like, once you break the sound barrier and go even faster, how come when you're behind the plane, you just don't hear nothing?
So I think there are several things that are coming into play in there. So let's deal with them kind of one at a time. So I'm sure you've all have had this experience. You're listening to an airplane, and it sounds like it's coming from there, and you look there, and there's not an airplane there. But you notice that the airplane's over there. Yeah, so it takes some time for the sound to reach you, so there'll be a displacement between where the airplane was when it made that sound and where it is now. So if we're moving faster than the speed of sound, something kind of funny happens. I don't know how I can convince you of this with drawing on the board.
It creates like a back of foam.
Yes, exactly. But so here is a wave of sound that was emitted some time ago by this airplane when it was here. And here's a wave of sound that was emitted by this airplane when it was there. And here's a wave of sound that was emitted when it was there. And if I drew this right, if you're moving faster than the speed of sound, then the result is that all of those highs add up to a super high that's like that behind the airplane. So the airplane's here, and this super high, it's a shock wave, so-called sonic boom. From where we're sitting, it's going to be seeming to go like that. So if we actually listen to the boom and look in that direction, we're definitely not going to see the airplane. But in fact, there's this cone of very loud sound that goes behind an airplane that's going supersonically. And I suspect you've never heard that, because they go to great lengths to keep airplanes from flying supersonically over the continental United States. So unless you've gone to a test range for the Air Force, you shouldn't have heard a sonic boom or an air show. More questions?
Why do you really not let the planes go faster?
Because that sonic boom will shake your windows and knock pictures off the wall. It can do actual damage. So you might know that there used to be a plane called the Concorde that flew supersonically between London and New York, but it would only go supersonically over the Atlantic where people don't have houses. So, I mean, great fanfare occurred when the first American broke the sound barrier, that is to say, exceeded Mach 1, and there's kind of an equal fanfare that happened when they broke Mach 2. But there's nothing special that happens at any other integer Mach number. When you go supersonic, you start to have these shock waves, and they affect the aerodynamics of the plane, and they shake the plane the same way that they shake your picture windows and walls. And best guess is that the first people who went supersonic in propeller-driven planes probably didn't survive the event. More questions? Well, let me mention something that is kind of off topic, but it fits in pretty well at this point. So, I hope you know that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, maybe contrary to some recent experiments, but I believe that strongly. But it is possible to travel faster than the speed of light in a material. So it turns out that light travels at a slower speed in glass than it does in air. And you can travel that fast through glass if you're a high-speed electron. And it turns out exactly the same phenomena occurs when a charged particle moves at greater than the speed of light in a material. You get the equivalent of a shock wave that is electromagnetic in nature. And it's called Cherenkov radiation, and if you ever get a chance, I guess this is as likely as hearing a sonic boom, but occasionally they do let you into reactors and you can see this dull blue glow from the reactor. That's all Cherenkov radiation of particles that are being emitted by the fission process and are traveling faster than the speed of light in water and are therefore producing this particular type of light. Other questions about sound?
I know that you can hear like bass or lower sounds through walls easier than higher pitches. Is that because of the wavelength?
So I don't know about the particulars of traveling through walls and things like that. But what it is true is that basically because short wavelengths, high frequency sound, the highs and lows are very close together, it's possible to kind of get some leakage. And so as a result, the attenuation, how fast the amplitude goes down with distance, is greater for high frequencies than for low frequencies. And I strongly suspect that that's what's going on in the walls, just kind of in spades. I kind of don't have time to hit the details, but let me mention one other word first, and we'll pick it up next time, and that's graphic equalizer. So how many of you have seen this on your stereo? Yeah, so what we have here typically is a bunch of bouncing bars. And those bars are labeled with frequency ranges. So that if, for example, there's lots of sound at a particular range of frequencies, say 100 to 200 hertz, then this bar will be particularly high. And if there's very little sound at, say, between 200 and 300 hertz, that bar will be low. So what the graphic equalizer is doing is it's making a graph of the amount of sound versus wavelength. Right? So if the flute comes in, we'll have a lot of sound at high frequency. If the bass guitar comes in, we'll have a lot of sound at low frequency, and we can see how the frequencies that are present in that sound are changing moment to moment. So this is going to play a huge role for us, and these things are called spectra. And we'll We'll take a look at it next time.